Okay, welcome everybody. Today is the October 1st, Upasika Day, and the theme is around meditation. And, for our Upasika days, we do sometimes sutta study, sometimes social, sometimes things that are, have a different use in terms of day-to-day life. And this is actually around sort of directly addressing meditation. And then the topic is around attachment. And so that the aspect of attachment and its effect on the mind, how to deal with it, how to work with it, and and of course, when we say meditation, it's also the reality that we can't separate out the rest of our life. That if we only meditated, then we wouldn't have to deal with. Wouldn't have to deal with certain things, like attachment.
Can I close that so we can hear the chainsaw?
Is that open?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, sure. So the... now we hear the buzzing of the... So when we're talking about meditation, we can't exclude the effect that something like attachment has on our day-to-day life, because every time we sit down to meditate, our day-to-day life is right there. We can't escape it. So that these themes go back and forth. So understanding the aspect of attachment in our daily lives also has a when we're able to understand it more clearly than when we do sit down to our meditation, then we have a much clearer ability to be peaceful, or to free the mind from the things that are obsessing it. And so that as when we think of the list that the Buddha gives of attachment, they come around certain themes of sense desire, views, practice and precept, assumptions of self. And then they start branching out into the different ways that it manifests, and the root is this type of attachment in whatever way, shape, or form. And then it ends up with attachments to, you know, the concern of our health, our job, our home, relationships, and children, pets, you know, there are all sorts of things. And, you know, when we recognize, I think with attachment, well, I mean, one of the things is, you know, seeing the different translations. The word, the Pali word is upadana. Upadana, and attachment, clinging, grasping. Ajahn Jeff uses sustenance, which is interesting. You know, we attach to something or cling to something, you know, assuming we're sustaining ourselves I think it's a really good translation. Needs to be fleshed out a bit, but that sense of we're actually trying to sustain ourselves, to derive sustenance from something, like say sense desire, and attachment to sense desire, where we're trying to gain some kind of pleasure, gratification, satisfaction, and it's not as if it's not pleasurable, but then the nature of attachment is that it keeps moving, looking for another object. So that this is why it's so important to understand how this attachment and clinging, upadana, works. And also another aspect of upadana is this sense of clinging or attachment to things as me or mine. And there's this behind all of it. There is, and I think that's your fundamental delusion, is we're opting for, you know, trying to make claims of identity around it. So we identify with with sense desire, or we identify with particular views, opinions, stances that we make. This is my view, and of course I am right. And when somebody has a contrary view, then what is mine is threatened, and we're off balance. So there is that, and that's a way to be, especially in terms of meditation and investigation. You know, is something, are we attached, or do we have clinging to something or other? And one of the ways to recognize that is this sense of me and mine, and so the sense of I that's involved. That makes it very clear. Much more clear that, okay, this is attachment. And if it's just sort of, whatever, then it's a very different feeling. So the also that when we consider the Buddhist teachings on attachment and relinquishing of attachment, this is a practical tool for freeing us from suffering. So the teachings are there to give us kind of the skill and ease of how to live in the world. So that really understanding how we create suffering and how we can free ourselves from it. So that the avenues of attachment are a good point of reflection And it's not that when you know, comes from, which is another view, I can't have any attachments to anything. If I'm going to be a good Buddhist, I shouldn't have any attachments whatsoever. I've got to free myself from all attachments. And, you know, basically you can't do anything, you know, because you're attached. You know, this just is... but it's really, I think it's really helpful and important. The Buddha is always pointing to suffering, cessation of suffering. That's the foundation of the teachings, and also that in the say in the scriptural language. There isn't, say, opposite or opposite correlation to upadana and samadana. And that's when one holds things rightly. So, like in the Thai language, when you take the refuges and precepts, samatansin. So it's like you determine to take, or you determine to pick up, or you determine to you make a commitment to. So it's like holding things rightly. So so that there is that's another lens of like upadana is like holding things wrongly, creating a problem, making suffering, making a mess out of it. And samadana is holding things rightly so that they're being a benefit and supporting one's aspiration for peace and happiness, well-being. So I think it's important to realize that there's these different lenses to be. You know, how do we hold things? And this is something that, say, Ajahn Chah gave a nice example of say, when you go into a dark place or it's nighttime, especially when you're out in the forest here, you hold on to a flashlight. You don't let it go. You say, it's not going to be attached to this flashlight. You know, and you know, you hold on to it. And because it's appropriate to hold on to it till you're out of the dark, right? And you get off the trail, be some rolling down the hill, because you're not attached to your flashlight. I mean, it's you know, so that samadana, you're holding it rightly, you're holding it correctly, and you know, sort of, you know, do you have clinging? Do you have upadana? Well, no, it's just a flashlight, and you're just using it for a useful purpose. So that applies to that. You start extrapolating from that. That's what you do with, say, like right speech, right action, right livelihood, right relationship to the world around you. You have to pick it up and hold it correctly, hold it rightly. And same with meditation. You've got to pick up a meditation object and hold it rightly. Because we can hold it with clinging and attachment. You know, I've got to pay attention to my breath. Huh? And I can't let anything else come in and intrude. And you wind yourself up and create all sorts of tension and tightness. And mind doesn't become peaceful. So that understanding what, say, that sense of upadana, attachment, and samadana, how to hold things correctly, how to hold things appropriately. So that's a, you know, when we're reflecting on on attachment or on clinging, then it is important to sort of say, well, there is this, say, option to clinging, and that is holding things correctly. So that Ajahn Jeff has a nice just the way he says that, saying so, well, one is that the whole book of Mind Like Fire Unbound is mostly all about clinging and freedom from clinging, and because one is the one of the aspects of the image of fire is that in order for something to continue burning, it's like fire is said to be caused by the excitation or agitation of the heat property, and then to continue burning it has to have sustenance and upadana, and its relationship to its sustenance is one of clinging or dependence, entrapment. And so then this is where we start to, one is this unraveling of this clinging, and then the Buddha pointing to that there's, you know, the mind has four forms of clinging, and of course these are just ways of flagging categories, and of course you can name your particular preference for clinging and how it manifests, but you know, how you proliferate out from there. But those are certain trajectories. So clinging to sensuality, clinging to views, clinging to precepts and practices, and clinging to doctrines of the self or assumptions of self. And then he says, in each case, the clinging is the passion and desire the mind feels for these things. To overcome this clinging, then, the mind must see not only the drawbacks of these four objects of clinging, but more importantly, the drawbacks of the act of passion and desire itself. It's that kind of that compulsion that we have to have, it has to be this way, I need this, I have to be a certain way. That compulsion is the... That's that passion behind the clinging. So I mean, they're, you know, it's hard to separate them out completely, but there is a certain sense. And of course, the mind does that by just following the path of practice that the Buddha lays down, and it's a virtue of concentration, discernment. It's a virtue. Provides the joy and freedom from remorse that are essential for concentration. Concentration provides an internal basis of pleasure, rapture, equanimity, and singleness of mind that are not dependent on sensual objects, so that discernment can have the strength and stability it needs to cut through the mind's clingings. Discernment functions by viewing these clingings as part of a causal chain, seeing their origin, their passing away, their allure, their drawbacks, and the drawbacks of their results, and finally, emancipation from them. So it's starting to see things in their context. So that's kind of an overview. Anybody have any questions? Yeah.
What's the seeing the allure
part? What's the draw? What's the pull? What's the assumed pleasurable aspect? Mm-hmm. Or what is the pleasurable aspect? Mm-hmm. You know, because that's what say like sensual objects are there. There is a very real pleasure that we get from them, but there's another side to it, unfortunately. But there's an allure there, and the same with like views. It's just really the allure of having views is and opinions, having a really clear, strong view. I'm right. they're wrong. I mean, that's very attractive. Who wants to go, "Oh, I'm wrong, you know, I'm all wrong again." You know, we prop up our views, and there's a certain security comes from that. Yeah?
How do you deal with relationships, attachment to relationships? And particularly, I'm being possibly be losing my dad, he has cancer.
Uh-huh.
You know, my attachment to my father,
yeah.
My father, you know, possibly may not be here next year, so.
Yep.
Letting go of an attachment like
that. Well, I mean, one is getting it in balance, in the sense that, like, letting go of attachment isn't a negating. Oh, like, well, he was just a, you know, four elements, blah blah blah. Yeah, that's really not what. It's not realistic. It's not useful. I think one is the attachments that we have. It's helpful to recognize the kind of pain that we have in not accepting, not being willing to accept, or being fearful to accept the reality of because. The reality is we all can, whether it's our parents, and the parents, they provide this incredible basis of stability in our life, and you know, so that's our kind of an anchor post for most of us. But, you know, it's for us, and we don't sort of think in terms of, well, you know, when all of us were born into this world, you know, we didn't come with this warranty. And so then it's realize, okay, you know, we have very uncertain due dates. And in order to really not waste our time or not be forgetful of our duties and say the blessings that come, then you know we need to be alert to that, and so that it's not part of it, of course, is that reflecting in those ways, just to, all right, one assumes that solidity and continuity, and but that's like our bias. But then when we're faced with separation, then sometimes it's really helpful to, you know, I mean, paying attention to that, but then paying attention to how can I really express gratitude properly? How can I really give support in a way that is both helpful to, say to my father, as well as helpful to me, to be able to start this process of being comfortable with that reality and not being regretful or remorseful.
Yeah, they're talking, talking about loss.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of a theme throughout my life.
Yeah.
And chaplaincy work, and there's the losses. Like sometimes, yeah, there's no date. It's going to happen, and then there's sometimes the losses that also happen in this life that had circumstances around them,
mm-hmm.
that influences in certain ways that. You know, these extra add-ons,
mm-hmm.
and how that, the mind that's understanding, but also the mind that gets caught when these extra add-ons are involved in, you know, losses.
Yeah.
you know, again, knowing loss of my niece, loss of my goddaughter, loss of, you know, parents, friends, you know, someone through alcohol, someone through other things, people doing, and there's these, it just, it's like I'm working, it's like sometimes I have this practice, they say, yeah, here's the clear mind, I know things are going to be death, and then there's these other pieces that just get so attached to it, you know, and other influences that others, then it just, it brings up, you know, a heated mm-hmm. passion of like, how did this happen, and mm-hmm. who did it, and it's just like, just working with it at times is clear, and other times it's like, feel like it's like just knocking me over with a sledgehammer.
Mm-hmm.
And how to just kind of, you know, I'm just trying to keep working with it, knowing it'll happen. And yeah, I can even teach this, like, yeah, it's going to happen to all of us, but it's like, boy, it gets convoluted. Those losses aren't so simple at times. There's a lot of things that go into them.
Well, there's a lot, yeah. Yeah, and there's, I mean, there is a lot of things that go into them, and I mean, especially when it happens to me, then it's different when it happens to somebody else. You know? So then, and that's important to. So, like, when you hear some, especially in your case, where you're, say, like, chaplaincy, when you hear stories of people and you're with people, and then it doesn't have the same impact of when it's real down home and personal when it's me that's feeling it and experiencing it. So, but which in itself is a really helpful reminder of, oh, there's this dukkha, is this sense of, again, the say that I, me, and mine that we inevitably function from. But that's a, you know, that's why the Buddha comes back to that as a huge source of dukkha, and how to be able to question that is really important, which doesn't mean, again, negating it. It's really, it's important to recognize it's that, again, how do we hold things rightly? What can I pick up that is and pick up and hold in a skillful way so that it's a benefit to myself and others rather than, say, picking up and holding and clinging in an unskillful way, which is upadana, because that ends up in suffering. So these are reflective devices. Okay. Yeah.
So I heard the word samadhansi in all my life, but never know that it means to hold it rightly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is there a way to hold the sila wrongly? Is
it, oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's, and we'll get into it, but you know, when we say, okay, I mean, there's all sorts of ways to hold it wrongly. I mean, it's just, you know, one, if I don't keep these precepts, and I'll go to hell. If I don't hold them in exactly this way, then, you know, then there's going to be some terrible disaster. I've got to get it right. And then we get really nervous and tight about it. We don't see it as a tool for freeing ourselves from suffering. We see it as a kind of a mandate that we have to fulfill, and we got to get the precepts right. We got to get the refuges right. You know, I've got to hold to the Buddha. So then it becomes a belief system, and as long as it's a belief system, it'll never free you from suffering. Same with precepts. It's like, you know, holding on to the precepts of, you know, something happens that is out of your control. That's like when I went back to visit family, and then, you know, there's all sorts of relatives and friends, and and people around and whatnot, and it's kind of there doing their thing. And of course, there's alcohol all over the place, and I'm just trying to be a monk, you know. I had this can of juice, and so okay, I'm having drinking this juice, and well, it tastes kind of funny. You know, and it's I don't know. Well, was it with Clamato? I don't know if I did Clamato, but it's a mix with vodka. And I look at the contents. God, it's vodka. Take this away. So there was lots of people who were willing to take it. So there's, you know, if I cling to my precepts, oh my God, I'm just, you know, such a failure because I, there was this, but you know, oh, I'm just going to be tainted for the rest of my life because I drank. You know, it's just, you sort of realize, no, the precepts are there to, and mostly when I go back to visit family, they do protect me. but in that case, it didn't. So, you know, it's not a big deal.
One other thing came to mind about that is I think it's easy also with precept to say, well, there's no way that I can keep all these precepts, so I better just not take them in the first place.
Yes, which is another thing, yeah. So it's kind of clinging to precepts in an opposite way, where sort of I've got to get them absolutely right or I won't take them. And so you don't take them, and well, you get the benefit from that. You know, so you don't sort of work with it and sort of see, how do these precepts work? How do I understand them? What benefit do they? How do I hone my wisdom so that I can be holding, working with, using them skillfully? So, yeah.
Apropos of views and opinions.
Yeah.
Is there and apart from right view,
mm-hmm.
As people living in this world, we're bound to form views and opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a skillful way, in the same way that we form relationships, as like people, we get married, we have children,
mm-hmm.
We might form opinions about what's happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a way to skillfully form them and to investigate them in terms of right view?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Do you suffer or do you not suffer? You know, and then, you know, so it comes back to that. That's why they like those Four Noble Truths are so important to. And it's not just, am I suffering in the sense of I, you know, am I totally miserable and losing the plot completely? But are there you know, nigglings and is there an edge there? Is there some agitation? Is there some feeling of discomfort? Is there some kind of conflict arising? I've got a view, and of course I've got this right view. but then when somebody doesn't agree with me, what does that do? Because we can come up with all sorts of weird views. And that's what friends are for challenging some of our views that we sometimes hold. And so then, you know, if you ended up without any friends, you know, there's all sort of, you know, they've disappeared because of your views. And so that, you know, you're able to hold a view, but it's important, all these sort of aspects, so both internally and externally, I start to pay attention. What's the result of the view?
One useful reflection that I have about views is that whether this view is right or that he was wrong, it's still conditioned. If conditions were different, I would hold a different view. Other people experience different conditions, they hold different views. This is totally inevitable. And, you know, any view is caused. And so, whereas we tend to think my view is, I hold this view because, and it causes because it's right. But if it was that obvious, everyone would hold it.
Yeah, I'd like to build on that.
Yeah.
Because, and we can watch someone, we have our views and we see other people's views, and what happens when we're in a certain view and we see another's view is actually causing more divisiveness, more pain,
mm-hmm.
and more death, and it's like, you know, I want to say, no, I am not perfect, but my view is pretty good compared to this view over here. And, you know, and kind of just taking what you're saying,
mm-hmm.
it's like, how do you go when you really see another view that is really causing pain on a level that it's like, it's almost
mm-hmm.
frightening, the possibilities that can come from it. And so how are we working with that?
Well, again, it's back to suffering and freedom from suffering. How do we implement Eightfold Path? Because one is, you know, are we going to sort of try to bash those views out of those people? I mean, that's not a useful, it isn't helpful at all. How do we, so that learning to work with our own views and then being able to it doesn't mean we can't say anything or do anything, but what's the motivation? Because if the motivation is, you know, I've got to get them or their views are so egregious or my view is so right, and I've got to get them over to my side, it goes on and on forever. And one is recognizing, yeah, these are views that are leading to suffering, not just for myself, but for others. So it's just seeing that clearly. And then also seeing, well, what is the conditioning? Just as Tankarjana was saying, these are conditioned views. Because it's easy to sort of turn that into, you know, that in the same way that we assume self, we try to solidify others into a solid entity, and you know they end up not being conditioned phenomena. They become these evil one-dimensional entities. Yeah.
There was an article in the Washington Post today about a black man who reached out to members of the KKK.
Mm-hmm.
And he met with several of them. And he came to them with the question, how is it that you hate people you've never met?
Mm-hmm.
And they were willing to talk to him. And he eventually became friends with the Grand Dragon of a certain state. And this Grand Dragon went on to be the wizard of all the KKK members. And eventually, he quit. And he apologized for pulling feet in his car. Gave his robes to this black man. And I think it's a really good story because it shows if you just ask a question about someone else's view, then you don't bring your views to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can have a dialogue that can be very
productive. Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's a sense of one is being willing to listen to others and sort of being, you know, being curious to be able to listen, but then also being able to listen to ourselves, because you know we've got a whole dialogue going on for it. So that opening up those avenues of communication and dialogue are really important without, you know, having a really clear agenda where it's going. Okay. The next thing that I want to do is actually go to the washroom. That's what I really want to do. And why don't we just have a really quick break? I mean, just stretch your legs and like no more than 5 minutes, and we'll be back, and I'll start another section on these four kinds of clinging.